Hi, Neil here, and this week we have the third and final episode of our Naturally Connected mini-series that aims to explore our connection to those everyday natural wonders that we have taken for granted for too long or may have forgotten about. In the previous episodes, we took a closer look at our connection to the sea and honeybees, so from very large to very small. And this time we go a bit more meta by exploring the connection between landscape and literature. Who doesn't love a good story? These days they come to us in a multitude of media, thick, fast, never-ending, and in many cases easily forgotten as yesterday's tales. But even in the noise of today, some books keep on drawing new readers, outdated in many ways, yet standing the test of time. But as our reporter Tamsin Walker asks, can those with strong, natural settings foster an appreciation of the world around us? An English county, with its fair share of well-known writers, might be a good place to explore that idea.
There's a memory buried deep in my mind of looking at the hills of northern England that served as the backdrop to my childhood home, and actually seeing them for what felt like the first time. I recall the deep green rise of the land made to look like patchwork by the dry stone walls characteristic of the area, and the tiny white dots of sheep going about the business of head down grazing as if nothing were about to change. Though for me, it was. Because ironically, or perhaps logically, this moment of genuine noticing occurred just before I moved away to begin life as a young adult in London, where any lush natural landscape that had once existed had long been covered over with bricks, mortar, concrete and steel, and where sheep would likely fear to tread. Though I've never lived among or anywhere even close to the hills of my early years since, they've continued to live within me. So too the rolling dales, the sprawling moorlands and craggy coastlines that form that part of the world. And I'm not the only sucker for their charms. The English county of Yorkshire attracts millions of visitors each year. Known fondly by those who love it as God's own country, this pocket of a place in Northern Europe has also travelled itself into homes, hearts and minds all over the world through stories so enmeshed with the natural world of their settings that the landscapes have become characters themselves. Perhaps most famously so in the works of the Bronte sisters, Charlotte, Emily and Anne, who grew up in the early 1800s roaming the rugged expanse of moorlands near their parsonage home in a village called Haworth.
Well, I always say to people, it's like history, but almost in a way it isn't, because it's like the players have all gone away for the day and we've just sneaked in for a look round.
Is that what it feels like?
Yeah.
Paul Crossley works as a volunteer at the parsonage, showing a very steady stream of multinational visitors how and where the Bronte sisters lived and wrote. And this windy day is no exception. The place is humming with the mixed language chatter of people who want to get closer to the literary family in one way or another.
Even on the simplest of levels, it's quite a thing to go to places to see where films were filmed, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And it's something like that with here. You get people who perhaps you would think wouldn't be interested, but they've been inspired to come and see the moors. And they're quite surprised when they see that the Brontes didn't mess about. I mean, they walked for miles and miles out there.
If they're allowed to develop, I bet they won't last 5 minutes around here.
Just get a dig in.
Yeah, or people will pick them very quickly.
Out there is a good description for the moors. For though they were close enough to the house to serve as a kind of extended back garden to the Bronte children, they're also wild, sweeping and sometimes foreboding, in a way that feels as though you're stepping into a different world. Likely even more so 200 years ago, when there were no phones to keep in touch in the event of descending fog or a step into an undrained bog, yet the family seemed to take to the moors as if they'd been waiting for each other.
The moors just seemed to pervade everything as far as Emily is concerned. And to understand it properly, you need to go right back to the beginning, really. So they moved here in April 1820. Charlotte was just shy of her fourth birthday. I mean, Emily would have been two and Anne was just 3 months. So it's not much of a stretch to say that the Moors helped them through the darkest time of their lives, really, because the following January, the mum became ill with cancer and the servants started to bring them out onto the moors every afternoon, weather permitting. So I think they saw it as a place where they could let off steam and just forget about what was happening at home for a little bit. And so they started to develop a love of the moors at that point, and that obviously stayed with them for the rest of their lives. And Patrick, the father, he was obsessed with nature himself, and they seemed to kind of inherit that from him.
Emily Bronte's love of the moors and of nature in general is particularly well documented, not least in her own work, in her only novel, The Brooding Wuthering Heights, but also in her poems. Paul describes accounts of her being able to get into a meditative state just by lying on her back on the expanse of tufty moorland grass and looking into the blanket of sky above. And standing up there on what feels like it could be the top of the world, the imagination doesn't need to stretch far to grasp what Emily found so captivating. But for the occasional walker in search of the landmarks that inspired her work, it's a place of instant, humbling solitude. To stop and take it all in is not only to be exposed to the gentle crest and fall of green, brown, and purple ground, but to feel how small we are as a species. The moors, they feel so knowing, so ancient.
What we're witnessing is something that's bigger than any of us. And I was looking at an old photograph from 1930 yesterday and thinking just to myself, well, everything just looks like it does now, but I wasn't here. And then I got this horrible thought that when I die, it'll still look the same.
It's not hard to imagine that it will. That the grass will bend and flatten to the whims of untethered winds, that the sun will draw out depths of colour that seem barely possible, that the clouds will gather and part in mesmerising, shape-shifting displays, and that come the late summer, the heather will cover vast swathes of ground in tiny purple flowers, just as it all did when the Brontes took their long walks.
So you can see how the moors start to take hold, really. It's not just a question of bobbing up here for a bit of inspiration if you feel a poem coming along.
No.
It really was a way of life. I think people don't believe me sometimes if it's a glorious summer's day.
That it's going to be windy.
Yeah.
There's nothing between the sky and the land here.
Well, do you know, you've hit the nail on the head there, because Emily said this is where she felt the veil between earth and heaven was at its thinnest.
But her depictions of her natural surroundings were not all blossom and romance. Far from it, she understood the powerful moods of the elements. In one poem, she gives voice to having witnessed a moorland bog that burst with such a violent explosion that the tremors could be felt almost 20 miles away.
That's what she loved about the place, that, you know, Mother Nature was in charge and that was that.
And do you think people pick up on that? When they come out here?
Probably, yeah. They might not even know what it is, but they feel some sense of awe, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So this all just worms its way into the psyche, doesn't it? And before you know it, you're just completely hooked and it's just going through and through you. Imperceptibly, layer upon layer, each little instant, isn't it? It just builds up, doesn't it, really? And before you know it, it's just part of you.
And the moors around Haworth are not the only Yorkshire landscape that can find its way into the head and the heart. Or to be put on the map by the stories of literary figures. High up on a rugged cliff overlooking the small northern Yorkshire fishing town of Whitby, the ruins of a 13th century Benedictine abbey draw visitors from across the world. Built on the same dramatic headland that's been the setting for monastic life for well over 1,000 years, one of its main draws now is a famous fanged count.
A large amount of people come because they perceive that Dracula is buried in there.
Oh, really?
Mm. So we get a lot of that. Very much so. There is a stone sarcophagus in the far corner.
Yeah.
Which is actually the remains of a medieval toilet. but there is a long-standing myth and perception that that's Dracula's grave.
Jamie, who works at the Abbey, says visitors come from as far away as New Zealand to see the non-existent grave. Likewise to the nearby church, which has a sign on the door reading, "Please do not ask staff where Dracula's grave is, as there isn't one." Bram Stoker wrote his horror novel in the late 1800s, allegedly while looking out over the haunting remains of the Gothic Abbey. And both the building and the 199 steps leading up to it feature, albeit briefly, in his book. But standing on the top of the rock face among the wind-lashed and carved stones that once served as a site of significant religious importance, it's clear that it wouldn't be anything like as evocative as it is were it not for the beauty of its natural setting, for the deep grey sky that pours in off the expanse of the North Sea directly below, the jagged onward march of the coastline in one direction, and the gentle stretch of the green fields undulating back inland. Towards another fabled landscape, immortalised through accounts of life as a small-town vet between the 1930s and 1950s. Through his alter ego, James Herriot, the real-life working veterinary Alf White carried the majesty of the Yorkshire Dales and no-nonsense nature of resident farmers to households across the globe. His series of books that have been widely translated led to a popular TV series, All Creatures Great and Small, which has just had a remake. The stories always held an appeal for me, and it wasn't just the characters, the animals and gentle humour that I found captivating, but the picture postcard countryside. In the original TV series, I recall scene after scene in which some spluttering old car would beetle along winding roads, hills rising in every direction, each take more stunning than the one before. Somehow it didn't seem possible that it could really look like that. But when my family moved us to Yorkshire to try our hands at smallholding, there we suddenly were, right in the middle of those picturesque patchwork landscapes, where the grass was greener than any I'd known before, the villages older, the lanes narrower, and the animals more plentiful. It was like living in the pages of a storybook. And it seems to have been a little like that for the real James Herriot, Alf White, who was brought up in the Scottish city of Glasgow and moved to the Yorkshire market town of Thirsk as a young man.
He didn't know Yorkshire. He always regarded in those days Yorkshire as an industrial county, sort of belching factory chimneys, which of course part of it was, because Yorkshire's a wonderful county. It's got everything.
It's God's own country.
It is God's own. It's got the industry and it's got the wonderful national parks. The landscape, I'm pleased to say, that especially when you go up into the Yorkshire Dales, the landscape hasn't changed a great deal.
Alf White's son, Jim, who appeared in the James Herriot stories as a boy and later became a vet himself, recalls his father recounting the first time he set eyes on the striking scenery that would become his adopted home and workplace, and the backdrop for his stories.
When he first saw the Yorkshire Dales in 1940, he couldn't believe it.
Wasn't expecting that.
And it couldn't have happened to a more appreciative man.
You know,
that was a great thing. He always appreciated everything. You know, when he went up into the Dales, he was tremendously appreciative of the landscape, of the wildlife, of the farmers.
It's an appreciation that Jim says was handed down to himself, though he recalls from going out on call with his father that the life of a country vet in James Herriot's day meant long and often very cold hours, and those steep winding roads that charmed television viewers such as myself sometimes had to be driven up backwards because it was the only way early cars could make it to the top. But for all that, Jim, who is now retired, is still moved by the countryside of his childhood and his dad's tellings.
I would say I'm very attached to the local landscape, the edge of the North York Moors. But I think for sheer excitement and fantastic scenes and scenery, I've got to say the Dales. The Northern Dales. Wensleydale, Swaledale. Fantastic. Fantastic. Gives me free songs to even think about it.
I get it, because it is fantastic. It is breathtaking, almost rudely stunning. And it's great to think that people in the furthest reaches of the globe have had the chance to vicariously experience life in the Yorkshire Dales through Alf White's tales, and to see in their own imaginations the valleys and hills he shaped into words, even though he never wanted anyone to know he was the man who'd written them.
He wanted to remain anonymous, that was the main thing. He did not want anybody to know who James Herriot really was.
Okay.
But the trouble was, he was such a good writer that everybody recognised the characters. So he shot himself in the foot. His cover was blown straight away.
Was it?
A man came up to me in Thirst Marketplace. My father told me not to say a word when his first little book was being published. And the chap came up, he said, I've just read a book by a fella called Herriot. And I said, oh yeah. He said, it's your dad, isn't it?
What did you say?
I said, what, how'd you make that out? He said, come on, there's somebody in it called Siegfried. That's Donald Sinclair to a T. He's described him perfectly. So there you go, you see. I said to my dad at the time, I said, you've shot yourself in the foot there, Dad. If you want to remain anonymous, no chance.
Wonderful. Love that story.
And there are many worse things than being known as one of the authors inspired enough by their surroundings and circumstances to create stories that allow readers to feel a connection with and love for places they may never experience off the page. The end.
This week's episode was produced by Tamsin Walker and edited by me, Neil King. Our sound engineer was Jürgen Kuhn. And that concludes our Naturally Connected mini-series. We'll be returning with a regular episode of Living Planet next week. In the meantime, if you have any questions, feedback, or story suggestions, please do send us an email or voice message to livingplanet@dw.com. You can also connect with us on our YouTube channel, DW Podcasts, where you can find plenty of other interesting content and Living Planet bonus material. That's it. Thank you for listening, and bye for now. Living Planet is brought to you by DW in Bonn, Germany.